right out of the box, we turn to our friend, writer, adventurer, Colin Fleming, who joins us via the telephone line from Greater Boston. Hello, Mr. Fleming.
What's up, Kimbalicious?
Have you... Woo, I feel better already. Have you...
I'm wearing your garb.
Oh, nice, nice.
Mailed me your personal shirt. We wear each other's clothes, listeners. I'm wearing that nice shirt from the official downtown radio program.
Well, if there's anybody who can make that shirt look better than it already does, it's you.
Yeah, I'm uniformed today, baby.
I like that very much. You also, I believe, must be about to be declared a national monument yourself after, I understand, setting a personal record inside the monument over the weekend.
Mini monument for me, next to the big monument, which has been there in Charlestown since 1843. But nobody has been up at 20 straight times. It's kind of apocryphal. I don't know that for an absolute fact, but I think it's a reasonable deduction on my part. I bet no one's ever been up at 10 times straight without stopping. But I went up at 20 straight times on Sunday. You're in there for a while.
And how many steps each time?
It's 300 to the top.
Lord.
94. Mm. So then 10 yesterday, 10 today, and if you do the step math, that's 24,000 steps. It's a lot of time. Well, it's only about like 5 hours in there, but you're working, man. That's not an easy one to do at 20 straight times, certainly.
Well, if the Park Service doesn't put up some kind of a plaque, I will have to write a letter and express my displeasure.
I feel like there should be something like that. It's funny. There's another new thing that I've noticed, that people who now see you climb multiple times, they start counting from the first time they've seen you. And they'll say to their wife, like, honey, that guy's climbed 3 times. Like, everything starts with the moment of their arrival. Nothing could have happened before they burst upon the scene. And I'm thinking, like, dude, this is number 18. It's funny. There was this older couple in there on Sunday. And he was in pretty good shape, and he was some kind of a vet. And he says to his wife, this guy's doing it for his exercise, and he's been up and down. He said, how many times? I was on number 14 at that point. And his wife says, well, how old is he? And the guy says to his wife, it doesn't matter how old he is. That's a neat trick.
Well, at least somebody understands.
Yeah, he appreciated it. I couldn't tell if he was like a Vietnam vet or maybe even Korea, but he was doing better than a lot of just kind of right in the middle of the pocket Americans who should not be laboring like they are in there. He was not resting. He was doing pretty well.
Good. Glad to hear that. Well, congratulations on your personal best, which I expect will be exceeded some weekend soon.
Oh, pressure, dude. I don't feel like I don't want to let you down now. My personal best before had been 16, but yeah, 20 is like, when you come to Boston, we are having a time, you and I.
See, I don't know. I don't want to make any statements that I can't back up later on. I walk a lot, but I walk on level ground, and going up and down 294 steps in a monument, that's a very different kettle of fish.
Well, it's funny because it will shut down like in January, and if you were here right now, you could be like the master of fitness. If you climb it more than once, if you haven't worked up to it, no matter who you are, same thing when it shuts down for me, you just won't be able to move after a few days. So like if anyone blows through town and wants to do this with me, it would be cruel of me to have you do it more than once. But if you stay in town and we go every day, we could be climbing buddies. Who knows? If you're out there, you're a comely young woman, maybe we'll hit it off. Romance, monument, you and me. There we go.
And perhaps along the way, what a segue this is, you could talk about horror films from a specific period, 1959 to 1973. Why have you selected those years to bracket our discussion?
Oh, arrogant caprice. No.
I drove one of those in college.
I think because what you have is you're out of that classic, second classic era of horror film that we get with the Hammer films, those revitalizations of Frankenstein and Dracula, that kind of thing. And we're trending into the modern horror film where the parameters are going to be extended. There are different rules, there was the absence of rules, and I think you have a quite clever horror film in 1959 that had a lot of influence that people don't often spend time reflecting upon. And that takes us through the next decade where things become increasingly progressive. You have, again, that notion of envelopes being pushed and climaxing, really. And what was an important horror film for a lot of people in 1973 with The Exorcist, which I guess probably many people would think of as the quintessential modern horror film, and I do not rate it highly at all, but it's a time of flux, and I think that some of the best films, often tabulated as the best films, horror films of that time period, are not really the best films, but you can find these nuggets that are rewarding in different ways that didn't really fit with the art house horror of the time.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the films that many would consider classics that you don't believe perhaps deserve that designation. And let's start with The Exorcist, which I guess it's safe to say from my perspective, I saw it when it came out and it scared the bejesus out of me, but it hasn't aged all that well.
I find it pretty giggle-inducing, to be honest with you. I think the horror, when I watch it from this distance, now I wasn't in a theater having that communal experience with people at the time, which might have been part of the appeal.
Oh, I think absolutely it was, yeah.
That horror contact high. And Jaws was like that a couple of years later to a different degree, but Jaws is pretty scary. And with The Exorcist, I see a child swearing a lot. And I think that was shocking at the time. That gets more shock cachet than it deserves, especially now when someone like me, I hang around somebody like my little mentee, Emma, and it's like, this with the Blair, nothing compared to what children say right now. So I think there is that shock value. The cinematography to me was like, okay, let's coat the film in ink from a squid. And the Godfather pictures were like that, too. And I just think that's a rubbish way to handle this. I didn't think the source material was very strong. If you look at the first page of the novel, listeners out there, if you have the novel, do this later tonight. Look at the first page of it. Look at the first sentence. It makes no sense. You can take this as a challenge to see that it does make sense, but it makes no sense whatsoever. You're going to be bogged down right from the get-go in the opening sentence. And Ray Russell wrote a book almost a decade before, The Case Against Satan, which encapsulates everything that's in The Exorcist, and it does it more pithily, and it does it with better quality. It's a great novel, a short novel. And if that had been the film that was made, I think that would have been a more successful venture. But it's just a laughable, sociological kind of, this is what we're doing at the time, this is the pop culture detritus. And it just doesn't resonate for me. I've always actually laughed out loud when I've seen it. And I don't have that kind of cynical reaction. It's not my nature to be cynical. And I just think, am I supposed to take this seriously? What's she doing with the soup here? She's doing this. And it's like, oh, no, it's not for me.
See, now I was, 15 when it came out? And I saw it then. And there was, of course, all the hype about it. And certainly you get caught up in that and the group reaction. And there was also, if you're 15, there was a lot of religious mumbo jumbo that made it sound a bit deeper than it actually was at the time.
Religious stuff is scary.
Yes.
Now, my grandmother, my good grandmother, I had two. One termed me a bastard, and she, when she learned that my parents were adopting me, she stormed out of the kitchen after saying, "Blood will tell," which is a great exit.
Wow.
But my good grandmother was not particularly religious. And yet she had this painting of a saint in her bedroom. And you know how it is when you get deposited with your grandparents, when your parents go away to do whatever. And this painting was very reverential. It wasn't like the flames of Satan were licking at the robes or anything. It frightened the life out of me. It's just a creepy kind of thing, rosary beads and all of that. And I remember I saw Pet Sematary, the original version, when I was in whatever youngish kind of age. And I remember saw it with a friend, thought it was really scary. And I saw it years later as an adult, a few years ago, at the Brattle. And I missed everything in it, that it was this tongue-in-cheek nod and a wink kind of horror film, right? It's not actually supposed to be scary. But when I saw it at a given age, whatever I was, 16, 17, thinking like, oh man, this kid, he's been hit by this car and he's out here and his brain's hanging out of his head. And really you see it later and it's like, okay, that's funny. That's witty. That's whimsical. But again, it's an age thing and it's a context thing.
Now, your other film that you're not convinced is a classic, I agree with you completely on this. And I think it's because I was too young to see it when it first came out. So I was an adult the first time I watched Rosemary's Baby. And I've never thought of that as a great horror film.
Some 60s stuff, there's like this schizoid nature of 60s art. Some of it ages really well, perfectly. And some of it just misses the bus completely. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of middle ground. And part of the reason I get hung up on Rosemary's Baby is that I know the Val Lewden-produced film, The Seventh Victim, which is a somewhat drier telling of the same subject material from 1943. It's the same subject matter done Val Lewden style. Now, Lewden was a superior filmmaker to Polanski. I think Polanski's Macbeth was really good and works as a horror film because Polanski, of course, by then, with the whole Sharon Tate and everything, he said to somebody afterwards, he was interviewed, he said, I know what blood looks like. And so I think he was working through some particular life demons with that film a few years later. But The Seventh Victim, the Val Lewden-produced film, the thing about Val Lewden is if people have less clothes on in his films, I don't mean that in a tawdry way, but they're just more informal. In other words, they're not costume pictures. That's kind of how you can gauge Val Lewden film and how its quality is going to be. If there's less of a budget for clothes, the films are usually awesome. They're classics. And you have Hugh Beaumont from Ward Cleaver. You would never expect him to be in this film about devil worshiping. And it's this locked room mystery in a way, and this detective film, and it just has a lot more going on and has more layers to it than you know what's coming with Rosemary's Baby. How early is that telegraphed? It's like the defenseman's carrying the puck out of the zone and he's looking cross-eyed. It's like, I'm going to hit you, left winger. Here comes the pass. Here comes the pass. Crosby steps in, picks it off, walks in on the goalie 1-0, right? That's the kind of film it is to me.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's talk about the good ones, the great ones, one might say, from this period of 1959 to 73. And let's go right back to that first year. And one of my all-time favorites, just a beautiful little nugget of a horror film with Vincent Price. So how can you go wrong? House on Haunted Hill.
He's so urbane in this film, and he is not the scene chomper that people often remember him as. In fact, when you watch his pictures, he is not that scene chomper, hardly ever. He riffs on the idea of that and that Brady Bunch, Tiki Wright special type of thing. But this is a very stylized film, and I love this film in part because it has what to me is a crucial component of any movie that is going to be an all-time favorite for me, and that is its rewatchability.
Yes.
The first Star Wars film has a high degree of rewatchability. Out of the Past, the Mitchum film, has a high degree of rewatchability. Certain Twilight Zone episodes, no, they're not films, but they have a high degree of rewatchability, where it's that ensemble and people are hanging out, right, that kind of thing. So the ones that are dependent upon the twist ending, it's like, well, that's a lot of what the package is. And that's what at times what horror films often can be, is the whodunit at the end, who's the killer at the sleepaway camp type of deal. And this film has some acidulous lines, a tartness to these lines that are reminiscent of like Dorothy Parker wit in this pop culture confection with great architecture, right? The Frank Lloyd Wright house. And Hitchcock sees this film and he thinks to himself, huh, they did this on the cheap. I can do something like that. I can work with a TV crew. And it's where he gets, in part, the idea for Psycho. But you have Elijah Cook, and we've talked about him before. When you have him in a movie, chances are it's going to be a great movie and a very rewatchable movie. And he is one neurotic, creeped-out dude whose creepiness, a little pervy, too, rubs off on you. He's like this you can feel the sweat of his palm through the screen, right?
Yes.
And he's like, it's just such a weird line, too. The ghosts are on the move tonight. Like, whoa. What does that mean? That's such a specific way of putting something like that. And he goes back to that refrain, this riff, again and again, and it really pulls you in. It's beautifully shot, the contrast of the black and the white. Now, it's not a noir film, but it almost functions as a film noir that's a horror film. It's also campy and fun and has these witty lines to it, and it's one of my all-time favorite films, not just a horror film.
Well, up next, a film that you introduced me to I had never seen before until you told me about it, and I watched it over the summer, and my God, it's one of the most, I describe it as heavy, because I just found myself tense every moment that I watched Carnival of Souls, and it made me never want to hear organ music again.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's this orgiastic organ music, too, isn't it? Like, there are devils just buggering each other. Like, it's bad, man. It is a film that makes you feel impure and terrified, and even as an adult, I'm not being fatuous when I say you're not going to want to watch it alone at night, that type of deal.
Oh, God, no.
And it's a one-off. It's legitimately terrifying. And it's a one-off, and I think that's part of the reason why it's so terrifying. None of these people are, like, professional actors. Herk Harvey, the director, who also plays the ghoul, who is, frankly, the most frightening bogeyman ever.
Yes.
Any horror film. And it's just, they get so much mileage out of these set pieces, this abandoned bathhouse on the salt plains. Like, that just sounds right there from my description, like it's going to be pretty eldritch. And the Twilight Zone type of premise is these kids are out there joyriding and they're racing over a bridge. Car goes in. Everybody's dead. They're searching for the bodies just to recover them. And you get the feeling it's hours later. Maybe it's the next day. And then one of the people in the car comes walking out. It's like, oh, this sucks. It's going to be she's alive. And there are these moments where sound, you get this, it just ceases. You have a lot of diegetic sound in this picture. And what that means is the soundtrack comes from what is occurring naturally. And Orson Welles would do this sometimes. He wanted to do it more with Touch of Evil, and the studio ended up dubbing all this music into it. But it's a very creepy effect in a horror film, and it's a shocking film. Now, it's one of my favorite films, but it doesn't have a high degree of rewatchability because it's legitimately terrifying. And Herk Harvey, the director, he made industrial films. Like, here's a film of what a good radial tire is. And then he saved his money, and he's like, I want to do one proper film, this horror film. And it's crazy that it ended up being this.
Another great one from Roger Corman with Vincent Price. Screenplay from Charles Beaumont, who wrote a number of terrific Twilight Zone episodes, and even featuring Paul McCartney's then-girlfriend, Jane Asher. Let's talk about Mask of the Red Death.
Yes, so this is 1964, and you have 8 films. It gives you an idea how deeply Corman was into this, of this Edgar Allan Poe and Vincent Price cycle. And this film, it's funny in a way, because when you describe it out loud, it sounds like this screwball comedy, this comedy of errors, right? Oh, I've mistaken you for this, and you're in here, and let me get you out of there. And yet, you have a lot of devil worshiping, you have orgies going on, you have, like, elements of necrophilia. There is a lot of bad juju in this film. Like, Poe, it's funny because Poe had such a horrible life, and he was so uncommercial in his time, and yet he wasn't just a great writer, he wasn't just somebody who was masterful with criticism, he wasn't just somebody who essentially invented the detective novel. I mean, Conan Doyle looked to Poe for Sherlock Holmes. He wrote these works that were autonomous works that were fecund for screenplays. And there were a lot of good ones over the years, but Corman was especially apt at the color in this film. It pops. It's beautiful. It's one of the best, I think, utilizations of color throughout all of cinema in the 1960s, when more and more things were, of course, being shot in color. The film, the reds in particular, they bleed. They bleed right out of the screen. They feel like you could daub at them. You want to get them to coagulate almost. And it's a very creepy film. And Price has to be urbane in this, and yet he's this landed gentry, this royalty guy at the same time, so he's out in the country, and he strikes that blend because he really did have range. He was, again, not this primarily this scene chomper, and you see that he was an actual legit thespian for material that a lot of people were, they weren't great Poe interpreters as actors. He always was. He was like Poe's main man, his go-to guy for these films.
I'm not an Anglophile by any stretch. I know a lot of people who are, but I do think the British seem to just do a better job, certainly in this time period, of doing the real psychological horror films. And one of the best, with a killer cast, Deborah Carr, Sir Michael Redgrave, from 61, The Innocents.
Yes, and that's another picture that we can double down on as just one of the better films, period, regardless of horror. Now, horror always, like comedy, is critically defecated upon. You will not see a horror film, you won't see a comedy, Buster Keaton, whatever it might be, for Academy Awards. That's why I never know why people care about Academy Awards, because it's never a good film that wins. If you go back through the years and you look at what did win, it's almost always utterly forgettable. If you're making great art that actually entertains people, you do not want to be winning those awards, at least the way it works right now. So The Innocents would never be something that would get that kind of, at least in its time, critical acclaim. But it is this open-ended mystery where we become part of the ensemble, because we're trying to figure out what's real here. What does this woman think that she is experiencing, and what is she actually experiencing? And the best horror, whether it's film, whether it's literature, it's going to be a bunch of different things at once. It's never just going to be, ooh, boo, I'm trying to scare you, because that really is, that's almost cheap. That's too easy. That's a carnival circus trick type of thing. And when you come to the end of this film, there aren't a lot of films that have a downbeat, atonal, boom, we have ended, ending like this one. It's the type of film that when you see it in the theater, it ends, and you don't stand up for a while. You don't like, oh, I'm rushing out of here, I have to get back to the tea. It's like, I'm just going to hang out. Did I really just see that? And I'm going to be up late tonight. I'm going to be mulling this over, not just because I'm scared, but because I need to parse this out. I need to know what actually happened here, what she saw.
And finally, one that I have not seen, I guess I clearly need to, from 1967 and Hammer Films, Quatermass in the Pit, although in the American release, it's called 5 Million Years to Earth.
Yes, the American release, the title, they were obviously going for that sort of sci-fi angle. And Quatermass is a great character. He is a detective of the supernatural. What might sound like a radical conceit, but that actually in pulp literature has been around for quite some time. Carnacki, the ghost hunter, and all of these other characters. It was like this mini genre. And the London Underground is being dug up. There's construction, like they're adding a new line or something. And these human remains are found in what seems to be some sort of a spaceship. So you have ancient humans, they're fairly ancient, next to these future people. It's like the beginning of Star Wars, right? Like a long time ago, galaxy far away, and yet it's kind of the future. But I like the idea that it's actually so far in the past, it's like the space-time continuum has lapped itself. And that's what we have going on here. And they bring in the man you always have come in on this scene, Bernard Quatermass. He is the guy who sorts you out when you have this kind of mystery. And what ends up happening is the investigation, it's subtle. And Hammer didn't do subtlety a lot, but it does subtlety here. These ancient memories start leaching into the modern world, which is a great idea. It was written by Nigel Neal, who did The Stone Tape, which is a BBC television production a few years later, which riffs on the same idea. But again, it's this whodunit, and it's creepy. It just crawls down your skin. It's not a jolter. It's something that, again, leaches through you and then saturates your entirety. And wonderful picture. One of the best, I'd say, Hammer films. Probably the best Hammer film of the 1960s, and maybe the best Hammer film excepting something like Horror of Dracula from 1958.
Awesome. I love it. I have to check it out now. Some great horror films to look at and a couple to think about a second time with Colin Fleming this week on Downtown. Now, you're the king of the Wall Street Journal this week too, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a Wall Street Journal op-ed today because it was 80 years ago today that Lou Gehrig walked off a baseball field in uniform for the last time. Now, he made his famous, I consider myself to be the luckiest man speech on July 4th, 1939, but he stuck around with his ex-teammates, I guess. He was kind of in that in-between land between ex-teammates and guys that you went to battle with on the field. And there's this photo that I would guess before today that less than 100 people on Earth knew existed. And we couldn't even figure out who took the photo. So if anybody knows and they want to claim a royalty, you should get in touch with me. And he's walking off the field after they've just swept the Cincinnati Reds, and he's in uniform, and he's still massive. His legs are massive, huge, like Alexander Ovechkin legs. And he's all by himself, and his back is to the camera, and he's going off to essentially, not too long thereafter, die. Mm. And it's this very intense photo, but a very composed, self-willed man still, and I think it encapsulates, at least to me, how baseball is the wisest of sports. So it's about autumn, it's about Lou Gehrig, and it's about sport that goes beyond sport.
Check it out in the Wall Street Journal, ColinFlemingLit.com. Always a pleasure, my friend. We'll talk with you again next Tuesday.
Sounds good.
Colin Fleming here on Downtown.